theme song from Mission Impossible. I actually got my theme songs mixed up there doing my shows. I had a postpone on another show, but perhaps that is an appropriate theme song for us as well. Today, we're looking at Mission Impossible of exploring the origins of Islam as we introduce here another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where we like to discuss every Friday important events for conservatives and others. And today we want to discuss with Robert Spencer, who's the director of the David Horowitz Freedom Center's Jihad Watch website, who's written a new and revised edition of his book, Did Muhammad Exist? An Inquiry into Islam's Obscure Origins. Well, Robert, welcome to the show.
Good to talk to you, Andrew, as always. How are you?
Well, this was a really interesting book. Well, just starting out, I guess maybe a brief introduction for our listeners. How could Muhammad not exist? Where did you get that idea?
Well, this is actually something that started to occur to me when I wrote a book called The Truth About Muhammad many, many years ago, back in 06. And I was researching the earliest available Islamic sources about Muhammad. Now, a lot of people say, how could you write a biography of Muhammad and then say he didn't exist? These things coexist actually very easily. I wrote the biography of Muhammad, but the more I looked at the earliest sources, the less I saw. That is, the more I saw that they were not historically reliable, that the earliest sources available for Muhammad's life date from a couple hundred years after the supposed date of his death, and there's just nothing before that that gives us anything solid to go on about who he was. And so it's very important to understand what the Islamic traditions say that Muhammad said and did, because that's normative for Islamic law, and that's what The Truth About Muhammad does. But then I decided to write another book, Did Muhammad Exist?, evaluating the historical reliability of those sources, which is actually very, very slim.
Well, just looking at those sources then, as you discuss in the book, where does the basic history of Muhammad come from? Where do we get that?
The stories of Muhammad mostly come from the Hadith and the Sirah, actually pretty much all of it. The Sirah is the biography of Muhammad. The Sirat Rasulullah of Ibn Ishaq was published in the middle of the 700s. And the thing about that is that Muhammad is supposed to have died in the year 632. And then you have over 100 years later, about 125 years later, you only then have the first biography of him. Now, that biography also does not exist in its original form. It was copied to a tremendous degree, I mean, really hundreds of pages copied out by a later scholar, Ibn Hisham, who is from the 800s. And so that's the only copy that we actually have of Ibn Ishaq's era or biography of Muhammad. It comes from 200 years after Muhammad is supposed to have died. Then there's the Hadith. The Hadith are reports, that's what the word means, of Muhammad's words and deeds. And the Hadith that are considered to be authentic by Islamic scholars are normative for Islamic law. Now, the thing about the Hadith is that they also date from the 800s, 200 years after Muhammad's death. This is supposed to be very voluminous. I mean, actually, this is very voluminous material detailing all sorts of things Muhammad did. There's volume after volume of it. I have about 35 volumes of it in my office here, and I don't have nearly all of these. And yet, none of it goes back to the time that he actually lived. None of it is even a close contemporary record. And so it's very hard to say, in fact, impossible to say, that there's been no legendary elaboration, that there hasn't been exaggeration, that there hasn't been myth-making, and so on. As a matter of fact, one of the foremost compilers of the Hadith literature in the 9th century, an imam named Bukhari, he traveled the Islamic world and collected 600,000 stories about Muhammad, 600,000 Hadiths, and he determined that 593,000 of those were fakes, were forgeries, were made up by various groups of Muslims in order to support their point of view in a dispute or to justify practices that they were doing. And that the other 7,000 he published, and that is the foremost Hadith collection to this day, and it is normative for Islamic law for the most part. But Bukhari, in determining that those 7,000 were authentic, did not base it on some actual evidence that these stories really did go back to Muhammad, other than the chain of transmitters. And that's like a game, big game of telephone, that you have Andrew Harrod tells Spencer, who tells David Horowitz, who tells somebody else, and then it goes down the line. Now, if all the people who are named in this chain of transmitters is reliable, then Bukhari determined that the tradition was reliable. But he never reckoned with the possibility that if you could forge a story about Muhammad, why couldn't you forge a reliable chain of transmitters? And the earliest Hadiths don't have the chains of transmitters to start with. So the whole thing is a house of cards. And there is absolutely, while there may be some reliable historical information somewhere in all the Hadith literature, there's no way to figure out which it is as opposed to all the myths and legends.
Well, and talking about these Hadith, these narratives or reports, as the word is translated, how does this oral tradition compare? I guess one interesting idea that occurs to me, how does this oral tradition compare to, say, the oral tradition of, like, the ancient Greeks? I mean, when you think of, classical texts like the Aeneid and so forth, they originally originated as oral traditions. How would you compare that with the Hadith?
Yeah, you're right. A lot of people explain away the difficulty that way, and they say, look, you're talking about a culture in which memorization was practiced widely, was prized, was much more extensive than most people are used to doing today. And so you have people memorizing the entire Iliad, the entire Odyssey. Why couldn't they memorize these Hadiths? And that's absolutely true. The difference is this. Even before we have manuscripts of the Iliad and the Odyssey, we have some indication that they existed. In other words, people refer to them. People say so-and-so recited the Odyssey, and we know that the Odyssey was something that people had, even though our actual copies of the Odyssey don't date from the time of these mentions. Now, in contrast, in the time of Muhammad and Islam, you have Muhammad dying in 632, and then you have no mention of Muhammad, the Quran, a new religion, a new holy book, nothing. No Islam, no Muslims. There is no mention of any of it for decade after decade after decade. And it's only at the end of the 600s and the beginning of the 700s that you start to hear about Muhammad at all. And it's only in the 800s that you start getting any of the stories about him. So then the question becomes, well, where was it? If these people came out of Arabia and conquered all this territory, which they did in the 630, 640, 650, 660, and they had memorized all the words of Muhammad and all these reports about what he had said and done, why did they never mention it? Why, when they were talking with the people that they had conquered, who left extensive written records in many cases, did they not explain that we were doing this based on this inspiration we have from our new religion? They never gave any hint that they had a new religion, and they aren't called Muslims, and they didn't call themselves Muslims. And so it's not like the ordinary way that we see oral traditions working, where even if we don't have access to the specific content of the tradition, we know that the tradition exists. Whereas in this case, there isn't even any indication of that.
Well, that's interesting. And thinking of other historical traditions, one question that occurred to me is, well, of course, the Muslims in this period of the 7th century, when they first sort of, as people describe, burst out of the Arabian Peninsula and conquered these various empires around them, how does Islamic historiography compare to, say, Byzantine historiography? I guess the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, had a much more established tradition of written records. I mean, would they not be more reliable in discussing the history of Islam, or for that matter, the Zoroastrian Persian Empire or other peoples surrounding the Muslims?
Yeah. See, this is one of the wild things about it. that the Byzantines are involved, and they did keep written records that are more extensive than those of the Arab conquerors themselves, specifically the Patriarch of Jerusalem, Sophronius. Sophronius was, according to the Islamic traditions that come around in the 9th century, he met Umar, the caliph, the leader of all the Muslims, at the gates of Jerusalem when the Muslims conquered Jerusalem in the around 637 or 638, and he showed Umar, the caliph, around Jerusalem, and invited him at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to go inside and pray. And according to the story, Umar magnanimously said, "If I go inside and pray, then my followers will claim this church as a mosque. And so I'm going to leave it for you Christians and not go inside and pray." Now, that's a very nice story. But the reality is that we have the actual writings of Sophronius that are not from the 9th century, that are from the 7th century, the time when all this happened. And Sophronius doesn't ever mention Umar. He talks a great deal about the conquerors. He writes sermons about how God could have allowed this to happen. And he writes about what the conquerors did, how they came and they destroyed churches and so on, and how he would talk to them and try to understand why they had done what they had done and so on. And they never, ever tell him that they are Muslims or that they have a new religion or that they have a new prophet or a new holy book. Now, this is what is so extraordinarily strange about that, that you would expect if they really did have these things, that there would be no problem with telling Sophronius about it. After all, this is supposed to be their motivation. But the fact that they don't and the fact that he doesn't give any hint of it is an extraordinarily telling indication that of what I'm saying in the book, that actually Islam arose later after the conquest. And that at the time of the conquest, there was no Islam. And that's why they don't mention any Islam.
Well, I guess this brings to mind the idea that, you know, history is written by the victors. And so it's, you know, questionable to rely upon any sort of a purely Islamic account of Islam. I mean, you got to think of, you know, what are the motives of what people are writing here or relating. Well, who are these people that are collecting these hadith or these biographers of Muhammad? I mean, you mentioned in the book, I found interesting, I'd never really thought about this before, that of the 6 canonical collections of these hadith, 5 were collected by Persians. I mean, Bukhari himself was Persian. I mean, his name Bukhari comes from being born in Bukhara in what is now Uzbekistan, and he published this definitive collection of hadith, the Sahih Bukhari, in 870. And then 4 of the other collectors of these 6 canonical collections of hadith were also Persian, like Muslim and so forth. And only one of them was an Arab from the area of Iraq, what is modern-day Iraq. And for that matter, who was Ibn Ishaq, who wrote this first biography of Muhammad in the 750s, about which only fragments survived that were then incorporated by Ibn Hisham in 830, in the 8th. Hundreds. Who are these people?
Well, the thing about it is, Andrew, that none of those people that you've mentioned are Arabs from the Hejaz, where Muhammad is supposed to have lived. And so it's kind of wild that if you're going around looking for stories of Muhammad and you're going around in Iraq and Persia, why is that? It's not because you don't know where to find them. It's because that's where they are. The stories of Muhammad originated farther north than we have assumed all this time. And there are a number of indications of that that I discuss in the book. For example, even the Quran itself is written in a dialect of Arabic that is more native to the Nabataean area around southern Jordan than it is to southwestern Arabia, where Mecca is. If the Quran really originated in southwestern Arabia, you would expect it to be in that dialect of Arabic that prevailed in that place, but it isn't. And if the stories of Muhammad were developed in Iraq and Persia, then it would stand to reason that they were collected in Iraq and Persia, and that the idea that they all come from Arabia is retrojected for various political reasons into the story, but they did not really take it did not really originate there.
Yeah, I guess it strikes me, I mean, this interesting idea that, you know, all of these collectors of Hadith except for one were Persians and the other one was from Iraq. You know, it seems to strike me that these are much more educated people coming from educated societies, more advanced societies. I mean, again, this former Persian Empire. And so it's precisely these people who are the scholars of Islam that supposedly originated among these Arab tribes in Arabia. And as you say, the stories were there in Persia and Iraq. That's where these people went looking for them, for these reports, these hadith. You know, that suggests that there was something that grew up in a more advanced society when Muslims became more settled down in these more in urban areas and cities.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that also goes along with all this is the fact that the earliest mosques don't even face Mecca. Now every mosque, if you go into any mosque in the world, it's got a niche in one of the walls called a Qibla, and the Qibla tells you where the direction is toward Mecca, so you know to face that direction to pray toward Mecca. And so the Qibla of the earliest mosques has been discovered by a scholar named Dan Gibson, and I discuss his work in the book. They don't face Mecca at all. They face Petra in southern Jordan, which is the place where the dialect of the Quran also comes from, and the general area where the Hadith were collected. So you see, it all starts to come together, and it's all about, it's not about Mecca and southwestern Arabia, it's about Iraq and Jordan in that area.
Yeah, and what about Ibn Ishaq and Ibn Hisham? Who are they, and what authority do they have to write a biography of Muhammad?
Well, the Ibn Ishaq, as I explained before, is the first biographer of Muhammad, and he was writing about 125 years after Muhammad's supposed death, and his writing does not survive. He died in Baghdad, you know, he was also another one from that area, and his writings do not survive. They come down to us in the writings of Ibn Hisham, who just copied wholesale large portions of what Ibn Ishaq wrote. And so Ibn Hisham is 200 years after Muhammad. He died around 833, which is pretty much exactly 200 years after Muhammad lived. He's another Iraqi, and he wrote a biography of Muhammad that is essentially just Ibn Ishaq with some other things added. And so we have these biographies of Muhammad written by people, once again, farther north than where you would expect them to be, and much later than you would expect them to be if they're going to have any actual historical reliability.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess that brings to mind another point you discuss in the book a bit is we have this transition in Islam from these various caliphates, and after the first four so-called rightly guided caliphs, these vicars or successors of Muhammad, the last Ali dying in 661, you then have this Umayyad caliphate that's based in Damascus that lasts until 750, and after that, then you have this Abbasid caliphate that is then based with its capital in Baghdad, and you talk about how there was sort of this accusations from the Abbasids in their caliphate that the Umayyad caliphate, which they had overthrown, was really this impious group of people. They weren't really devout Muslims, and the Abbasids were the better Muslims. And so that plays into a role. You talk about the Hadith, that their questions like, were people just fabricating Hadith in order to make ideological attacks on each other, like the Abbasids trying to blacken the name of the Umayyads? So does that then play into all of this historiography of Ibn Ishaq and Ibn Hisham, that they're writing in a period under the Abbasid Caliphate, along with all these collectors of Hadith like Bukhari?
Yeah, absolutely. And see, it's not just that they're trying to blacken the name of the Umayyads, but it's how they're doing it. that's interesting, because imagine if what I'm saying is true, just for a minute, that I mean, it is all true, but I mean, just if you're skeptical, set that aside for a second and think about it this way, that if the Abbasids take power in 750, and it's only after that we start to see this proliferation of material about Muhammad, and Muhammad is supposed to have died in 632, then one thing you've got to explain is why we're only hearing about this now. That is, you've got to explain to your people why it is that all this time they haven't known all this. And so they made up this other myth that the Umayyads were impious and not religious. And so these people who supposedly had the words of Muhammad ringing in their ears and actually sat at his feet are supposed to have gone out and then immediately disregarded everything he told them and acted in a completely different manner from how he had told them to act, and ignored what he had taught and never even mentioned his existence. But you see, it's an attempt to explain the fact that now, all these centuries later, you are starting to hear about this figure that has that supposedly lived a long time previous, but about which nothing was said.
Yeah, and I also brings up the issue, too, of, you know, you discuss as well that the Shiites and the Sunnis have their own differences over what hadith they accept and or even a Quranic interpretation. So just all these Abbasids, Umayyads, Shiites, Sunnis, it becomes a big question here. Whom do you trust? Who's got the right faith here, and what ulterior motives are involved?
Well, to some degree, yeah, but we have to remember that the Shiite hadith and the Sunni hadith, the Shiites don't accept the Sunni collections and vice versa. At the same time, however, the content is pretty much the same. I mean, if you don't know the Shiite hadith, I have one set of Shiite hadith and then more Sunni hadith, because of course there are more Sunnis in the world and there's more occasion to deal with them than with Shia. But I do have a volume of Shia, a set of multi-volume set of Shiite hadith from Al-Kafi. And if you search around, you can generally find everything that is in the Sunni hadith, but it's just in a different place. And so sometimes you have to do a bit of hunting.
Well, you've discussed here before how many of these early mosques, they have their Qibla, their direction of prayer, seems to point towards Petra in southern Jordan. So again, away from Mecca, which is supposed to be the Orthodox direction of prayer, the Qibla, and the language of the Quran suggests that it originated in that area of the Levant, a more northern dialect of Arabic and not the dialect of the Arabian Peninsula. What about this claim then that the Quran repeats in various verses like Surah 16, verse 103, that the Quran is written in clear Arabic? Is that true?
No. As a matter of fact, Geert Pwin, a scholar of the Quran, has said, and it's certainly true, there are large portions of the Quran, a lot of words, a lot of concepts, a lot of terms, where it's nothing that is based on the actual meaning of the word, where Islamic scholars have decided that this is what is meant and go with that. But it's essentially something that they are applying to the text rather than actually working from the text. And so it's a lot of the meaning of the Quran, in other words, is established by convention, by the agreement of Islamic scholars, and not by the actual meaning of the text.
Yeah, and how does this? I found this rather fascinating in the book. How does the nature of the Arabic alphabet play into the trying to understand the Quran?
Well, that's a wild thing about the Arabic alphabet, that the earliest manuscripts of the Quran do not have the diacritical marks. Now, the diacritical marks are little dots that go above or below various letters. A lot of the letters in the Arabic alphabet are exactly the same in form as other letters. And then the only way you can distinguish the one letter from another is by the diacritical mark, by the dots that are above it or below it. And so if you don't have those marks, then sometimes you're going to have no way to tell what letter is meant. And that can create some very interesting situations. There's a famous joke, actually, that probably originally wasn't a joke, but something that really happened. And that is in the beginning of the Quran, chapter 2, verse 1. It says, I'm looking in the wrong place. I was going to read it out here and in the wrong place. Yes, this is the book, chapter 2, verse 2, actually. This book, there is no doubt in it. Now, there is no doubt in it in Arabic is la raiba fihi, but the R and the Z in Arabic, in the Arabic alphabet, are identical, the identical character. It's just that the one of them, the Z, has the dot over it and the R doesn't. So, and also it's the same with the B and the T. It's the same thing except for the diacritical marks. So a kid was reading this out and he says, la zaita fihi instead of la raiba fihi. And this is, this book, there is no oil in it. Instead of there's no doubt in it. And this is the kind of thing, that's a little joke, but that's the kind of thing that arises from the indeterminate nature of the Quranic text.
Yeah, the diacritical markings didn't come until, you, I guess you say, like a century later or so into the text of the Quran, so it's really hard to see what exactly the original Quran said.
Yeah, there's just no way to tell. Actually, you know, when the kid read, there is no oil in it instead of there is no doubt in it, that reading is just as plausible. I mean, it doesn't make any superficial sense, but there's a whole lot of things in the Quran that don't make any superficial sense. And so there are some scholars who have determined that the Quran was originally a Christian text that has been reimagined, essentially, that with the alterations in the diacritical marks has been made to say something else that is related to the original text, but not always the same. And this, if you strip out the Arabic diacritical marks and think about a lot of the difficult passages in Aramaic instead of Arabic, then they start to become clear.
Well, has there always been then another theme you explore? Has there always been one text of the Quran?
Well, that's another thing. It's interesting because it's been a staple of Islamic apologetics up until quite recently that there is only one text of the Quran. And Muslim scholars and apologists have boasted about this and said that not a bit has been changed, not a word. Every manuscript is identical to every other manuscript. It's a miracle of preservation that Allah has granted to show that his book is indeed divine, and that it's very different from the situation of the Bible, where there are so many different manuscript traditions and so on. And the fact is, there are a whole lot of manuscript differences in the Quran that only now are Islamic scholars starting to admit. Now, there is a tradition, actually, that Muhammad was given the Quran in seven dialects, and this is obviously another tradition that it was invented in order to explain why there are variations in various different manuscripts of the Quran, that Muhammad got it in different forms. And there are some that try to just discount these differences on that basis. The problem is that you're talking about a text that's supposed to be perfect, and yet it exists in multiple versions. Well, which is the perfect one?
Yeah, that was interesting. Muhammad supposedly, according to this account, he received the revelation, could be pronounced in seven different Arabic dialects, and so then there were seven traditions of the Quran of how it could be read?
Yeah. Seven traditions, 10 readings, all sorts of different things, different ways in which the Quran is read. These are different manuscript traditions that are acknowledged by Islamic scholars. But you really start to try to pin them down on it, and they start to get very ambiguous about it. They will tell you that some of them, I just actually had a Twitter fight with this guy who was saying that there's no difference. They're just differences of pronunciation, but there's no difference in the text. And then others who say, oh, of course there are differences in the text. It's just that they're minor and they don't make any difference to the meaning. And the fact is that there are some that do make a difference to the meaning. And so this is something that is an unresolved contradiction for Islamic apologists, because some of them say that the text is perfect, never changed, and consequently there are no variants, and yet at the same time Muhammad received it in 7 different versions, but all those are perfect, you see, and so it's all right. Every last different diversion, every diverging tradition is all perfect and protected by Allah, and it starts to become absurd because, well, what did Allah really say? Does he really say all these different things that are sometimes different from one another? It becomes clear that the apologetic argument, the more you look at it, just doesn't hold up.
Yeah, and you know in the book that the traditional Islamic narrative is that when it came time to collect a written copy of the Quran under the third caliph of after Muhammad, Uthman ibn al-Affan, that the person who collated that, Zayd ibn Thabit, if I'm saying his name, that he was supposed to collect the Quran in the dialect of the Quraishi clan from which the Quraishi tribe from which Muhammad came.
Yes. And so then you got to wonder, okay, if he's supposed to collect it, and that's what the Islamic tradition, that he's supposed to collect it in the dialect of the Quraysh, the tribe of Muhammad, then why did Zayd ibn Thabit presumably collect it in 7 different dialects? It doesn't make any sense, and it's contradictory. And the fact is that there's all sorts of things that are contradictory in the Hadith because you have, as I said at the beginning of the show, different groups making up different stories about Muhammad to support their own position. And so you have some saying that the Quran is one, and then others saying, well, we have to explain all these divergences and so on. And so it's no longer one. It's all these differences that are really all perfect and good in themselves.
So Zayd ibn Thabit, he collected this one version, but what about in the Quraishi dialect? Then was there any collection of the other dialects, or did they just remain oral traditions?
Well, there are collections supposedly by other Muslims at the time, but supposedly, according to Islamic tradition, the Caliph Uthman is supposed to have collected all the differences, all the different versions, and standardized the text of the Quran and burned all the variants. And so there were others who collected the Quran besides Zayd ibn Thabit, but presumably they're versions do not survive, and there ought to be one text, the one that was standardized by Uthman at the time. And so this doesn't explain why there's this multiplicity of different readings of various passages. And that is clearly because this is a book that underwent a lot of editing, and that there were scribal errors and so on, copyist editors errors, and it's just like any other human manuscript, these differences, these divergences are going to come in. And so they mitigate against the idea that this is a perfectly preserved text.
Well, and you mentioned, though, that the Quran that's used mostly in the world today is based on a 1924 edition from Al-Azhar University in Cairo, Egypt, this leading center of Sunni Islamic scholarship, but there are also some other versions that are popular, like, say, in Africa. Explain that.
Well, in Africa, you have the difference between the Hafs and the Warsh traditions. These are two different traditions of the Quranic manuscript. And like you say, one of them is standardized in the edition from 1924. But the other continues in Africa, and primarily North Africa, so that you have the Warsh tradition. The Hafs is one comes from Cairo. Then you have the Warsh persisting in other areas. And even though the Saudis and others have tried to send this standardized Cairo 1924 Quran around to the whole world and make it the only Quran, there are still people who prefer the Warsh and who have it. And Hatun Tash, the now world-famous Christian apologist, rather, ex-Muslim, who was stabbed at Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park in London a few weeks ago while speaking to Muslims, she went to Morocco some years back and collected, I think, 20-25 different versions of the Quran, not just the Warsh Quran, but others as well, and found an astonishing multiplicity of manuscript traditions freely available there.
So you're saying then that the Al-Azhar 1924 edition that's claimed to descend then from what Zayd ibn Thabit collected under the third caliph, Uthman, whereas these other versions, like the Warsh in Africa, where do they come from? Do they also come from Zayd ibn Thabit, but they just have a different dialectical reading?
Well, that's the idea. That's that according to Islamic tradition, these are the different dialects in which the Quran was collected, and that's all. It's not really anything more significant than that. It's just minor variations based on people's manner of speaking. Now, this is not borne out by the nature of the differences, but this is what they say. Really, you have a book that was put together by a committee, and there are different different versions of it as it was being standardized, and this is why we have these differences. And then they were explained away in various ways in the Hadith literature.
Huh. So there, the Warsh has claimed that, say, after Zayd ibn Thabit collected the finalized Quran, then someone else wrote a different edition that had this other dialectical interpretation of it.
Well, you know, the whole idea that there's just one Quran and that they all the others come from it is questionable in itself. It may be that there were various people working, perhaps together, perhaps at cross purposes, and putting together various literature that would be the sacred scripture of this new religion. For example, in the beginning of the eighth century, rather, the 700s, there are a couple of Christian writers who speak about the Quran, very specifically chapter 2 of the Quran, as if it were a separate book. And it appears from that it likely was a separate book at that time. Otherwise, why would you talk about it that way? And that it was incorporated into the Quran later. And in general, seems as if various Jewish, Christian, and Zoroastrian traditions were being adapted and ultimately combined together into the one book.
Well, you know, thinking of all these things and about these questions about the Quran, now, one thing that really stuck out is you described this Islamic history about the 657 Battle of Siffin, where you had then the fourth of these so-called rightly guided caliphs. Ali was battling over control of the Muslim community with Muawiyah, who later goes on to become the founder of the Umayyad Caliphate. And there, supposedly in Islamic tradition, one of the soldiers under the leaders under Muawiyah says, well, let's call for an arbitration. And they they mount on all of their spears these copies of the Quran, and they say to Ali and his forces, "We follow the Quran. We will do what the Quran says." So, you know, let's all arbitrate on the basis of the Quran. I mean, how believable is that that you'd have an Arabic army putting copies of the Quran on their spears and holding them up?
Yeah, see, I retold that story, as a matter of fact, in the book, in order to illustrate how far from reality the Islamic tradition really is about this, that at a time when every copy of the Quran had to be copied out by hand, and just a decade or so, or actually less than a decade, about 4 or 5 years after Uthman is supposed to have collected the Quran together and burned the variants and sent copies of the Quran to all the Islamic provinces, just a few years later, every average soldier has a copy and is willing to be carrying it around in the middle of a battle where it could be desecrated and fall on the ground and get covered in mud or blood or who knows what. This is just absolutely unbelievable. And it stands in stark contrast to the actual literature of the period, where you don't find any mention of even the existence of the Quran. And it's not until the 690s, 40-some years after the Battle of Siffin, that you start to hear about quotes from the Quran, and even longer than that, that you start to hear about the Quran as such, the Quran itself. And this is something that mitigates against the traditional story altogether. And here again, you see, when the traditional story doesn't make any sense, then you got to wonder what the actual meaning, what the actual events really were. There's no way that the Islamic story of the Battle of Siffin could have happened. There's no way that could possibly be. Because there's no way that all these jihad warriors are going to be risking their copies of the Quran in that way. And so we have to look for alternative explanations.
Well, when do you think then that history of the Battle of Siffin was written? I mean, who would think up the idea that, you know, at what time and what period would anyone think of this idea that, oh, yeah, an Arab army goes around and everyone has a copy of a Quran, you know, it's like American soldiers landing on D-Day or something, that they would all, you know, have, you know, maybe some pocket Bible or pocket gospel or something that the army had printed, or they'd gotten from their chaplains or something. I mean, you know, you think about the, you know, Gutenberg invented his printing press in 1451 and set off this printing revolution. I mean, who would think up this idea that an Arabic army has all these Qurans?
Well, that comes from At-Tabari, and At-Tabari is a 9th century historian. And so there, once again, we see that these traditions all start to arise in the 800s. And that's so much time elapsed after Muhammad is supposed to have lived, that there's plenty of time for legendary elaboration.
Yeah, Tabari, you mentioned, yeah, he died in 923, so again in the Abbasid Caliphate. So I guess, you know, only there, I guess, would you think of in Baghdad, which, you know, sort of known as the golden age of Islam and you know, this advanced society. I guess only there would you think of people, you know, carrying around written documents. It's not something that you can imagine you know, Arabic tribesmen doing. Well, how do modern Muslims deal with this? Have you ever gone to any modern Muslims and said, look, this whole idea of this battle Siffin and everyone going around with their pocket Qurans over it just doesn't make any sense? I mean, how do they respond to such criticisms?
No, I've never discussed the Battle of Siffin specifically with any Muslims. It might be interesting to do so sometime. Maybe I'll do it. But the thing is that when you start to discuss these things, it immediately becomes fraught. When you start to discuss the Quran with Muslims, they generally tend to start to become defensive very quickly and angry very quickly. And it's a very big emotional hotspot that makes it hard to just have a rational discussion about the available evidence at hand.
Yeah, and, you know, you go through other, speaking of history, you go through other historical things in the traditional Islamic account that seem questionable. Like, for example, maybe Peninsula in the traditional Islamic account, they're often described as being dominated by pagans. And so it was this Muhammad who came along and said, you know, I'm the final prophet of God. The angel Gabriel has met with me, and I'm here to bring you the true word of God from the single God. Is that true? Were most Arabs at the time pagan?
Yeah. Although there seems to have been a kind of vague Abrahamic monotheism that didn't have a well-defined theology. And that seems to be what the warriors, the Arabian warriors, came out of Arabia with and conquered the Middle East and North Africa and Persia and so on in the 600s. And it was on that framework that Islam was hung.
Well, you talk about, I guess that brings up then another issue of these Arab conquests. Has anyone speculated how did such Arab conquests come about? I mean, if we're looking at here at this book, questioning whether Robin Hood figure, you know, maybe there's some Arab leader, but you know, all this stuff about a person being called Muhammad and doing all these things sort of made up afterwards. Why would such an Arab conquest have occurred in 7th century Arabia? What might have happened to cause such a historical event?
Well, for one thing, the Byzantine Empire had exhausted itself in a series of wars with the other world power at the time, the Persian Empire. And they were the two superpowers of the day, but they were, by the time of the Arabs pouring out of Arabia and conquering North Africa and the Middle East and Persia, ultimately, they were both drastically weakened. And the Byzantines nominally controlled Syria and Egypt and the area around Arabia in general, but they didn't even have enough troops to man the forts in those areas. And so, for example, there's an Islamic tradition about Muhammad, and here again, this is a 9th century tradition, but I think that there is a detail in it that is likely to have been accurate for whoever it may have actually originally referred to. And this is that Muhammad, late in his life, went to Tabuk, which was a Byzantine garrison in northern Arabia or southern Syria, depending on your point of view. And he wanted to fight the Byzantines. This was going to be the first time that he was fighting Christians as such. And this is the occasion for, according to Islamic tradition, the revelation of a lot of the material about how Muslims must fight and must wage war against Jews and Christians. Anyway, he gets to Tabuk, and there's nobody there. And Islamic scholars have interpreted this in various ways. That they were afraid of Muhammad, that heard about him, and the Byzantines left, things like that. But it's unlikely that the warriors of a great empire, even one that was exhausted and depleted after various wars, would be afraid of this warlord out of the desert. And so that strains credulity. But it's much more likely that the Byzantines just didn't have the personnel to man all the forts all the time. And so their forces would travel from fort to fort and stay at one for a while and go on to the next one and so on. And so there just didn't happen to be anybody at Tabuk when Muhammad got there. This story may have some kernel of historical accuracy, but probably what we have in it is a story of some warlord that was incorporated into the Muhammad myth.
Well, what about, for example, another thing you go into on issue is was Mecca, where the Kaaba is now, and where Muhammad supposedly began to preach his message of the one of being the final prophet of the one single God. Was Mecca a great trading center in the Arabian Peninsula, where the pagans were worried about someone like Muhammad coming along and taking away the pilgrimage trade from Mecca to all these pagan idols there at the Kaaba?
That is the story. The Islamic tradition tells us that Mecca was a great center of pilgrimage and trade, and that the Meccans believed, the pagan Meccans believed that Muhammad, by preaching one God, was threatening the pilgrimage trade, and by making it so that these guys would not think there were any gods there to go to pilgrimage, make a pilgrimage to worship. And there were in the Kaaba in Mecca 360 idols, and those 360 idols were supposedly of all the gods of the Arabians. And then story goes that Muhammad, when he conquered Mecca, he went in and cleared it all out except for an icon of Jesus and his mother. And that doesn't seem to be in the Kaaba either now, but that's the story. In any case, the problem with the idea here is that Mecca doesn't show up in any of the extant records, that there doesn't seem to be any indication from actual records from the 7th century that it was a center of trade or pilgrimage. It was just a dusty outpost in southwestern Arabia. And imagine if you were a tradesman and you were traveling between India and Europe on the Spice Road. Imagine that you were doing that. And so you would cross Eastern Europe from Rome into Constantinople and then into Syria and down across into Iraq and Iran and into India. Perfect sense. It's a more or less of a straight line or a descending line. Whereas if you're going to go to Mecca, then you're making a vast detour across miles and miles of trackless desert waste with nothing there. Now, here again, this strains credulity. Why is it that anybody would do that when there was, you know, you're talking about a small number of people that must have been in Mecca, and the trade records, the records of tradesmen that do exist, I discussed this in the book, that do exist from that time. They don't show that the tradesmen were going to Mecca at all. And so a central element of the story of the canonical story of Muhammad as told in the Hadith and Sira literature, it doesn't hold up historically.
Well, what about as well, thinking of politics and history, you talk about the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Is it really true that this is Islam's third holiest site? Where did that come from?
Well, you know, even the canonical story of that is pretty shaky, because the Muslim claim to Jerusalem comes from a hadith in which Muhammad takes a journey taken at night by the angel Gabriel on a winged white horse with a human head called Burak, and taken to the Temple Mount from Mecca, and then is taken into paradise where he meets all the prophets before him and then meets Allah himself. And this is a very good story, really, but even in the story itself, Aisha, his famous child bride, says he was with me the whole night right here. And so it's represented as a dream in any case. But it is according to – because of that story, Jerusalem is never mentioned in the Quran. But because of that story, Jerusalem is considered a holy place in Islam, and the Temple Mount is claimed as an Islamic holy site. And this is completely ahistorical because, well, the story here again dates from the 9th century, and there's no indication from before that of any Islamic contact with Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, chapter 17, verse 1 of the Quran refers to a journey at night, taking the prophet to the farthest mosque, which is Al-Aqsa. Now, conveniently, there is the Al-Aqsa Mosque that was built in the 690s on the Temple Mount today. But Muhammad is supposed to have died in 632, so how could he have gone to the Al-Aqsa Mosque if it was the one that is meant that is in Jerusalem now when it wasn't built for 60 years later? So clearly another Al-Aqsa Mosque was meant. And since Al-Aqsa just means the farthest, it's whatever mosque was farthest away at the time that all this was written. It seems much more likely, in other words, that the Al-Aqsa Mosque was built in order to give content to that story and give it a specificity, but the story comes first and is much vaguer.
Well, you know, a lot of this you're discussing about politics and faith here, a lot of this sort of sounds like Islam is really sort of the Arab equivalent of like Roman ideas about Romulus and Remus and the founding of the Roman Empire. You know, are academics in modern times, are they doing their jobs and really doing a good job in critically analyzing Islam and where it came from?
No, this is the massive failing of modern day academia, and because of the leftist Islamic Alliance, political correctness, fear, the historical investigations that I'm describing and talk about in the book in much more detail are being done by people who are not in institutional academia or people who are not well respected within it. But within it, there's just no serious historical investigations of these things going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems like, I guess reading your book, it seemed to me like if only half of this stuff that you write about is true, it seems like the faith of Islam collapses. The kind of research that you and others have brought forth, indeed from past academics who studied Islam from, say, the 19th century, is it making an impact on anyone? Are people changing their minds about Islam?
Well, yeah, sure. As a matter of fact, this doesn't have anything to do with me, but an Islamic scholar in Germany a few years back, Mohammed Sven Kalisch, a convert to Islam. He was an Islamic teacher, and he studied the same things that I studied for this book and came to the same conclusion, that the idea that Muhammad is a historical figure just doesn't have any basis, and he left Islam as a result.
Well, is it offensive to study a religion like this? I mean, doesn't such criticism exist all the time with, say, Christianity or the Church of Latter-day Saints?
Yeah, that's what gets me about this, Andrew. This is a historical investigation. I mean, I'm sorry if it bothers some people, but the reality is that historical investigations like this have been carried out on Judaism, Christianity, other religions for centuries, and nobody's getting killed, nobody's getting threatened, nobody's saying, oh, you're doing this out of hate or something like that. And so why is it different in this case? Because the Islamophobia industry has such a powerful influence in the establishment media, and they've been able to hoodwink people into thinking that there's something wrong with even asking this question.
Well, how do you think in the future more of this kind of research that you've done, will it get out more, or more people think you're going to start sort of waking up, taking a more critical eye and pursuing what you've done?
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. I have every confidence in that. As a matter of fact, I did the revised expanded edition that's just come out of this book because there's a lot more interest now than there was 10 years ago when I wrote the first edition. And there's been a lot more that has been discovered that I thought needed to be part of the record and needed to be added in. And so it's all in the new edition.
Well, indeed, it's an excellent read, and I guess we can only hope that you will blaze a trail and that the truth will set you free, as the Gospels would proclaim, that people will take a more critical and less faith-based approach, just blind faith, zealot faith to Islam, and look at more of these really interesting issues that you brought up, some really critical issues that I think need to be brought up here. Well, for our listeners
there,
you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod. And we've been talking to Robert Spencer, the director of Jihad Watch, where I also write, who has come out with a new and a revised edition of his excellent book, Did Muhammad Exist? An Inquiry into Islam's Obscure Origins. And where could we get a copy of your book, Robert?
It's at any self-respecting bookstore. If there are any brick-and-mortar bookstores out there, ask them to order it. It's also at Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
All right, then. Well, thank you very much, Robert. And for our listeners out there, tune in next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, where we examine important issues for conservatives and others. Thank you very much.